Tonight on Arena, Caitlin Hughes talks to us about her new novel, The Alternatives, and we celebrate the 30th anniversary of Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. We start this evening with sad news, in fact. Very sad day for all lovers of the short story, as the death has been announced of the Canadian writer Alice Munro. She was 92 and she had been living with dementia for the last decade. Delighted to be joined by short story writer Mary Morrissey. Very sad day indeed for all lovers of the short story. I think it's safe to say, Mary, and as the Canadians themselves say, she was their Chekhov. She was of that stature, really, wasn't she?
Absolutely. And she was certainly a sort of a writer's writer. I think Richard Ford said, you know, you'll just mention her and everybody just kind of generally nods. That's how good she was. She was very unusual in that she dedicated her whole writing life to the short story, which is very unusual for a writer of her stature. I mean, generally the short story is seen as a kind of an apprentice work and that you go on then to the real work, which is the novel. But she never did that for various reasons.
Yeah, and indeed she won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2013, marking her several collections of short stories at that time. There are those that say, in fact, it was an insecurity around. She didn't believe herself good enough to tackle the novel, yet, as you say, writers consistently quote her as being, you know, fitting this the epic scope of a novel into a few short pages of a short story.
Yes, I mean, the stories really were like small novels. I mean, most of us think of the story as the Arrow in Flight, short, and, you know, a glimpse of a life or a small incident in a bigger picture. But in fact, her stories had the density, had the complexity of a novel. And as her career continued, in fact, her stories got longer and more complex. So her first had 15 stories, and by the end of her career she was producing collections that maybe would have 8 stories.
So they had almost doubled in length.
Exactly, and each story was like being immersed in a novel about the character she was writing about.
That length, as I said, the Canadians refer to her as their Chekhov. That link with Chekhov, several critics and award ceremonies, everything have linked her to Chekhov. What in particular does that, do you think, in her writing, Mary?
Well, I think it's the subject matter. Her people are, I mean, her landscape was Ontario, southwestern Ontario. She grew up on a fox and mink farm, and she stayed in the territory of her childhood for her writing. So these stories are about ordinary small town folk, women in particular, who have, you know, sort of complex and are complex lives and dealing with dilemmas about betrayal. She was very good on betrayal and, you know, thwarted ambition and desire. She was also very good on desire. And well, I think these were things that Chekhov also managed to.
Were there particular stories that you connected with, Mary?
Well, I'm thinking in particular of a story called My Mother's Dream, which is written from the point of view of a child still in the womb. And I think it's the most fascinating story because the whole story is written from this point of view. And people tend to think of Alice Munro as being, you know, a very realist writer, you know, sort of very grounded in everyday life. And yet, even though this story is about sort of domestic, it's a domestic story, the point of view is so unusual and it takes you a very long time because it's, again, a long story, to work out, oh, this is actually a pre-verbal, you know, pre-born child, you know. And so she, like what she did, I think, for the form was that she saw how elastic it is, how much you can fit into a story. And, you know, she had a very serpentine way of telling a story so that you're sometimes set up for the story to go in one direction. I'm thinking in particular of a story in her Runaway collection called Chance, which is about a woman who strikes up a conversation with a man on a train and then and throws himself from the train. And she wonders, well, she was not interested in talking to him and she was a bit brusque with him. And most short story writers would just write about that. But, you know, in fact, the man throwing himself from the train is almost incidental. What goes on to happen is how that incident affects the young woman. And, I mean, she follows her through the rest of her life. It's not just that one episode. It's, you know, how this ripples throughout her.
Absolutely. And as you say, extraordinary that somebody can take an incident like that and make it about something totally different in the space of a short story. Thanks so much for being with us this evening, Mary Morrissey there, remembering and paying tribute to Alice Munro, whose death has been announced today. And we're back with you. As I said, we had intended this evening to speak with the poet and novelist Caoláin Hughes about her third novel, The Alternatives, and we certainly will do that. But we lost Caoláin just before the break there. She's back on the line with us right now. Caoláin, we were speaking to Mary Morrissey, obviously, about the death of Alice Munro. It was announced earlier today. I think you've taught some of her short stories. What makes her such a brilliant writer, do you think?
Wow. Well, she's one of a kind. She has been a contemporary Chekhov, I think. And I'm so glad that she won the Nobel during her lifetime, because I do think that her body of work is just really extraordinary. She writes a lot about the women's experience in a way that I don't know that anyone has dedicated so many books to that, and kind of given license, I think, to a lot of writers to write these contemplative, ironic, but also serious stories. That, and she's very innovative in terms of how she handles time. Any one of her stories you could select and kind of teach for a week.
Yeah, and you'd learn a lot from that. 14 volumes of short stories, and then Dear Life in 2012, a mixture of autobiography and short fiction, and then the Nobel Prize in 2013. Well, may she rest in peace, and I hope that will bring all of us to take a look at our Alice Munro's collections on our bookshelves again, and maybe read one of her stories tonight just in tribute to her. No matter which one, as you say, Caoláin, no matter which one you choose, you'll probably be very satisfied by it. Let us move on, however, to your own new novel, The Alternatives, the story of four adult sisters, Alwyn, Nell, Maeve and Rona, orphaned when they were very young, now lead independent and separate lives. But Alwyn goes missing and the sisters find themselves coming together once again as they face up to the loss and try to plan a way forward, the loss that they had as children, that is. You were talking about the female experience. I was noticing, actually, today I was thinking, Orchid and Wasp, which was the first story, was brother and sister kind of at the heart of it, I suppose, in some ways. Two brothers then at the heart of the Wild Laughter. Did you feel you owed a group of sisters a chance to have a chat with each other?
I did indeed. I think I needed to practice on the brothers and take one woman at a time before this. But no, it's been fantastic to spend time thinking about sisterhood, and I also, you know, I suppose I now have, I'm in the trap that I'm writing about adult siblings in all my books so far. Yeah. I think the next one I'll have to look at colleagues or something like that.
Yeah, because I presume your own siblings immediately look and try to work out which ones are them, do they?
They'd have no luck doing that. I don't write that way.
Yeah, well, if you had siblings like this, you'd have a very clever family. These four sisters are one of them more accomplished than the next, it has to be said.
Yeah, so I loved the idea that writing a book about sisters could also be writing a book about women at work. You know, there's a geologist, a philosopher, a political scientist, and a chef, and they definitely do walk into a bar. that kind of became inevitable at a certain point. Mm. But yeah, so it was really appealing to me that a book about sisterhood could also be, you know, a book about women expressing themselves through their professions and trying to do meaningful, fulfilling work that gives them, you know, energy and purpose.
And I have to say, I mean, even in the opening section, we meet Elwyn, who is the eldest of the sisters, and she's the geologist and very interested in climate change, and it allows you to discuss all of that. But we meet her in a lecture scenario, and I have to say, the information that you were giving to us in that lecture sounded like a qualified geologist to me. Then we go on and we get some very fine culinary advice from her sister Maeve, some wonderful political analysis from the other sister, Rona, and a bit of philosophy thrown in from the American-based sister Nell. Where did you find all of that knowledge, or was it just sitting there in your head waiting to go on the page, Caelan?
I'm a terrible procrastinator, so I tend to not try and do too much research when I'm writing a novel. Otherwise, I wouldn't write any. You'd be getting one every 20 years out of me. So I tend to write into areas that I'm already interested in. And I'd been particularly interested in geology, I suppose, and geography from a young age, growing up on the west coast of Ireland, and was writing a lot of the book in Connemara, which is just, to me, a really emotionally resonant landscape and one of the most, you know, beautiful landscapes that I know, where you've got this limestone and granite kind of breaching through the fields and these wind-stripped low-lying hills. And, you know, colours a painter wouldn't get away with. And it's a wild, dynamic landscape while at the same time being somehow immovable. You know, despite all that weather, it still remains. And there was something in that was a bit like Alwyn, the central character. So maybe something about being there. And there had been a few geology books that I read over the last decade that left a bit of an impression. Basin and Range by John McPhee is one. And he's actually not a geologist, but it's an extraordinary book. And he says at one point that if he had to restrict the whole book just down to one sentence, the sentence that he chooses, the summit of Mount Everest is marine limestone. And which tells you a lot.
Yeah.
And then there was another book called Notes from Deep Time, A Journey Through Our Past and Future Worlds by Helen Gordon. And that was another book that had made quite an impression. And but actually the chef character was the one I had to do the most research for.
I was going
for.
To ask you that. You know, after you've given me the geological tour of the west of Ireland, when I come to visit you, will I then be getting some very fine local food cooked by you? Because that's what Maeve does. She's not the youngest of them. No, Nell is the youngest, isn't she? Yeah.
Maeve is the second youngest.
Yeah. Yeah, so Maeve is the wonderful culinary. She's kind of an Insta star, really, isn't an Instagram star. This was where you had to do most research.
Yeah, I did, because I'm vegetarian and I'm a very impatient cook. And, you know, if I start cooking, I kind of want to eat within 30 minutes, you know. And so I needed to really try and get into the mind of someone who doesn't think that way about food. I love food, you know, and I'll happily have someone else prepare it for hours. But I just don't have enough chill. So I actually had to ask a writer friend, you know, mostly because of the fact that she's not a vegetarian, just a vegetarian chef. So I wanted to be sure that I was writing kind of representatively, ambitiously for. So I asked a writer friend who was a chef for a long time to look over the recipes, and I ended up having to change some of the starters, which was mad, that all of a sudden, a bit like a painting, you just cut out a few colours or change a few colours and suddenly the whole thing comes together. Hopefully.
Now, I'm not going to ask you where you learned your political analysis and where you learned your philosophy, because the other two sisters give us a section of that. But I guess one of the overriding or overarching shadows in the book is the death of the parents of the four sisters. They were all in their teens, the sisters, when the parents died. Talk to me a little bit about what that gave to you, to the story of this set of siblings.
Yeah, I knew I was setting a novel that would be, I was trying to set this almost exactly when it would be published. I missed by a few months, but I'm set in mid-2023. And so the process of trying to, just the world is changing so rapidly that it felt kind of urgent to set the story as close to now as possible, which meant I had to anticipate what the coming years would be like while trying to capture the current moment. And that process reflected what the novel's about, which is this effort to lurch forward in the story as the carpet's being pulled from beneath our feet. And so these sisters, I think they're maybe more primed for the moment that we're living in than other people, because they did lose their parents early, and they're already familiar with the stages of grief, you know, and they know that the last stage, when it comes to the moment that we're in and the climate crisis, can't be acceptance. In one way, I was thinking about how we think about the future, the present and the future. And it's just so different to how our parents thought about the future, or really how it was thought about at any point in human history. I think there must be more general pessimism now than ever before. And I'm interested in how individuals respond to that, you know, species-wide phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because there's so many different ways to respond. From denial to retreat to despair to feeling guilt or shame or rage, or to seeking out social support and community connections, to getting involved in more and changing your own behavior and getting involved in change making action. And so the sisters do respond quite differently.
Yeah, and I guess that, again, having a political analyst, a philosopher in the case of Nell, the youngest, and the obviously the geologist and the culinary aspect in there as well, it gives you a chance to discuss those big topics in a character-based way, as opposed to here comes the message, folks. You know, these people are able to have those type of conversations in quite an easy way. And there I was reading along from the viewpoints of the various sisters in the opening section of the book. We get, a chapter for or section certainly from each one of them. And then suddenly I'm reading a two-act play in the middle section of the novel. It is a classic kind of the characters come together in an enclosed space and they're kind of trapped there and they have to have their conversations, as it were. How quickly did that form of putting a play essentially in the middle come to you?
Yeah, it was a shock to me too. And it only happened about 3 pages before that section. I write into the dark without a plan, so I never know where a novel's going to go. And I kind of write quite slowly in one draft. So it was about 3 pages before I kind of emailed a friend of mine and I said, oh no, I just have been struck by this image and I think it wants to be a play. And as soon as I kind of said the words out loud, I knew that there was no other way to write it.
No taking them back.
No, it was more of an instinct than any kind of artistic or intellectual choice. But it is, in this part of the novel, a family reunion story. And I love a big, messy family gathering story. And, you know, what happens when family comes together? It's just so much talk and competitive talk and crosstalk and people trying to direct the conversation one way or steer it away from something else. And so I just needed to get out of the character's way, and the play script really allowed me to do that.
Yeah, and of course, for the most part, it's dialogue we're dealing with in the play section of the novel, if you like. And that has been referred to in your previous writing as well, the quality of the dialogue in the previous two novels, Orchard and the Wasp, and indeed in The Wild Laughter as well. But I did wonder, you have wonderful stage directions, wonderful prose in your stage directions. Do you think of that middle section as, it's not quite written as a play? Yes, it's dialogue and it has stage directions. You kind of novelize those stage directions, if that makes sense, or if I'm reading it correctly.
Yeah, I took all the license and then some. I think I'd be fired if I were to submit it as a play, I think. And I think I almost see it as halfway between a play script and a screenplay, because it's also quite visual. There's something maybe equivalent to a camera movement in those directions, like where to look, which you can't really do in theatre.
No, but
unless you're a very good actor.
Yeah. Well, you just pull the focus and make sure they're looking at you. That's what you do there. Nevertheless, it does suggest to me that quality of the dialogue, and even the way you're talking about the moving of the camera. Is there a screenplay or indeed a play in there somewhere? In you?
That would be for someone else to determine. I'd love to think so, but
Well, as I suppose, if you're writing in the dark, who knows? You might just open the page and find yourself, oh look, I've got 63 scenes written. This must be a screenplay or this must be a play. I'm wondering about that title, The Alternatives, as well. How alternative are the four Flattery sisters? The Flattery is the family name.
Yeah, I suppose there was an element of thinking about it as the characters, but I also really liked The Alternatives for this kind of all-embracing quality it had. It accommodated so many things and it adapted to the story as the story developed. So I couldn't have written this title without any, you know, this book without any, with a different title. There was something about living on the edge of something, living in a way that somehow deemed unusual or tentative, and that there's the promise of change or alternatives to the status quo, you know, some alternative to the kind of sense of inevitability. And so that also the title allowed me to accommodate different modes of storytelling. You know, the fact that there are there's lectures in there, there's Zoom conference, there's emails, there's the play scripts, there's even like a little excerpt of a philosophy book for children that Nell is composing with her nephew. So it just became this all embracing thing. And at the end, I thought I might have to change it, but there was no other title that could stand in.
There was no alternative, shall we say. The other aspect of that that I thought was interesting in terms of that alternative aspect, as well as those various storytelling forms that you're speaking about, the family units of the four sisters are all very different and certainly not a traditional, none of them traditional family units.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I suppose at the beginning, when I thought I'm writing four sisters and they all have PhDs, I was simultaneously laughing and just, you know, crying, because I knew that my publisher would just be staring at one another blankly, you know. It's not exactly bestseller material, but I also thought it was quite funny. And one of the PhDs, of course, the chef, hers is honorary, which she gets the right slagging from the others because of, but there was, yeah, so there was the alternatives in the ways that they're living their lives, both, you know, in the family kind of unit, but also in the kind of gig culture that some of their jobs are composed of. And then, so it's a larger thing to do with how we arrange ourselves. So on a personal level, say with that gig economy set up, and maybe the family choices, but also on a community level. If you look at, you know, Maeve, who's living on a houseboat in London, the barge community runs a certain way, and she you know, goes around collecting produce from local farmers and the like in the region. And then kind of arranging how you arrange yourself on a geopolitical level. And so with Rona's work, looking at direct democracy and citizens' assemblies, and, you know, in an earlier iteration, I suppose, of her work, thinking about the North in general and the changes that are happening on this island and on these islands in general. You know, as I was writing the book, everything was changing so quickly. For example, with the Supreme Court's decision around Scotland's second referendum viability and all of that. So that really does seem to those alternative modes of arranging ourselves seemed to be speaking to the moment that I was trying to write about.
Well, indeed, that was, now I will get a chance to give the final paragraph of what was to be my introduction before Alice Munro died and our main introduction changed. While The Amendments is a family tale, it also deals
with the alternatives.
It contains big themes. The Alternatives, rather, is a family tale. It also deals contains big themes, climate change, political instability, food shortages, and philosophies for living. All of it present in the novel, The Alternatives. Thanks so much for speaking with us this evening, Keelan.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. That's Keelan Hughes talking to us about her third novel, The Alternatives, which is published by One World. Blackwater Valerie Opera Festival is set to take place across locations in Lismore, Yall, Dungarvan and Castlemartre from the 27th of May through until the 3rd of June. Among the repertoire to be performed is a production of George Frederick Handel's Giulio Cesare, which will be performed in the grounds of Lismore Castle in Waterford, with conductor Nicholas McGeegan leading the Irish Baroque Orchestra and a cast directed by Tom Creed, including in the cast mezzo-soprano Sharon Carty, who plays the part of Sesto. All three of them, I'm delighted to say, are with me in studio this evening here on Arena. the story of Caesar, I guess we'll all know it probably. Maybe we'll know it from our study of Shakespeare, or maybe we'll know it from Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. But what is the story that's told in the opera here, Tom?
So, yeah, the Handel's Julius Caesar is the story of Caesar and Cleopatra in the aftermath of the Roman Civil War and during a civil war that's broken out in Egypt. So Pompeo, who's used to be Caesar's ally, has fled as a refugee with his family to Egypt, and Caesar has followed him. Pompey has looked for help from Ptolemaeo, who is one of two sister king and queens who are brother and sister but are married to each other. Ptolemaeo and his rival and sister Cleopatra. Ptolemaeo thinks that the way to get into Caesar's good books is to chop off Pompeo's head and send it to him.
Not a good move.
But that's a terrible idea because Caesar is a man of principle and finds this behavior appalling. So the consequence of this is Pompeo's wife, Cornelia, and son, Sesto, are orphaned and are widowed and are refugees in this strange country. And while the characters try to reconstruct the country in the middle of a war, we discover that actually they're some of the most unsuitable people to be doing that. It's a bit like the characters from Succession have walked into contemporary geopolitics.
Well,
the middle of that, they fall in love with each other and betray each other.
You've got Succession into it, you've got love and betrayal into it, and you've got this idea of the refugee within it as well. It is obviously a modern story in many ways. Yes, it's the Roman Civil War, but it wouldn't take much to fit that into contemporary scenarios. What way are you presenting it in that regard? Is it in a period costume? Is it in a contemporary feel, or is it timeless in some ways?
I kind of like to think maybe that it's happening in the period and in the contemporary world at the same time. So we're playing the characters as modern characters. The costumes, you know, the tailoring is contemporary, but I would say there's a lot of acknowledgement of the Baroque in there. I've done a whole bunch of historical opera repertoire with business suits and mobile phones, and actually with this we're doing maybe something that's slightly different, something that's slightly more abstract, but something that can resonate with this extraordinary location where we're doing the opera. So we're, you know, we're in the yard at Lismore Castle, which has in it, you know, in itself also all kinds of history and a relationship between different countries.
Which is wonderful for, I would guess, for a director to have that kind of mix of the ancient and the contemporary and all of those things in a potential setting. I wonder what it's like for a conductor to have to contend with the beautiful music of Handel and period instruments here, I think, from the Irish Baroque Orchestra.
That's
as
correct,
well.
Yes.
Nicholas, so they bring their own set of difficulties with them and their own sets of joys with them. And you're in an outdoor setting here, essentially. What challenges does that present to this music?
The challenge is the challenge that would have been the same in the 18th century and now, whether you're using modern instruments or not. They don't like being rained on. They don't like being baked. If you're doing something in the open air, you might suddenly decide that the local flora and fauna, flying and not, decide to join in. It's rather nice in this opera. We do actually have an aria with answering birdsong from a violin. Who knows? We may get the real thing.
You may get the real thing on the night.
The time is, shall we say, nightingale time. So we might get a real one. And that's very that's very beautiful. You know, it's performance, it's life.
Where does this Julius Caesar opera sit in terms of Handel's repertoire?
He came to London in 1710 and with opera. That company failed. And the chap who ran it was called Owen McSweeney, ran off to Venice with the money.
Is he an Irishman, Owen McSweeney?
I don't think he's Greek.
Okay.
And then he went off to sell pictures back to rich English people from Venice. And so Handel then had a few years off opera. And 1720 was the Royal Academy was founded, which was the Royal Opera, as it were. And this opera is in 1724, so he'd been going for 4 years. Huge success, wonderful. He could, because of the royal backing, he could get fantastic cast. If you think of it as a modern Broadway show, this would be Lady Gaga, Ariana Grande, and Tony Bennett, in the same show.
Which are you, Sharon Carty?
That's the million-dollar question.
Oh, Lady Gaga, I think.
You are playing the character of Sesto, and this is one of the famous trouser roles, because originally this would have been written for one of the famous castrati of the time, in fact, wouldn't
no,
it?
No, this is written for a lady.
Oh, this was written for Sesto itself, was actually written with a lady in mind.
Yes. Margherita Durastanti, who had sung for Handel longer than anybody. They met in Rome in 1708, so she was one of his pals.
So it is a male character. Was this one of his? Was one of the first times that he had written specifically for the trouser role in this way?
No, I'm glad to say that castrati were always quite rare. Other castrati were very grateful for that, I'm sure. But it was considered. Cross-dressing was considered fine on stage as well. Ladies, of course, love to play men's roles because it was the only chance they got to show off their legs.
Sharon, was that a major consideration in accepting this role?
The primary reason, I would say.
Because they'd be wearing, like a pantomime boy, wearing silk pants, as opposed to being a Georgian lady who would have basically dressed as a sofa. Yes,
hence the trouser role of the title, the way it's put. The character of Sesto, he is the son who's quite angry, obviously, that his father has been killed.
Yeah, he goes on quite the journey throughout the opera. He starts as in quite a weak position in a lot of ways. And we were just talking about this during rehearsal, that as his arias develop during the opera, he garners courage and resolve and ends up ultimately, spoiler alert, killing the bad guy at the end. Mm. So he really kind of grows up. And that's kind of shown through his mother's eyes, that she really kind of sees him then as a worthy follower of his father, and she's kind of pleased with him.
What kind of music does he? I'm going to listen to your big aria in Act One. What kind of music does Handel give to the character of Sesto?
There's a lot of, I think, teenage rage and kind of, you know, which is understandable for a character who's seen his father's decapitated head been presented on, you know, on a kind of quite a political stage. So there's a lot of kind of building himself up and duty, and he feels honour bound to avenge his father's death. So that's a big part of the text of a lot of the arias. And then there's one moment of kind of calm in his second aria, Cara Spemi, where it's very reflective, and he's kind of invoking the spirit of his father to.
But certainly in this Act One aria, you can give me the title if I'm giving a rough guide here, a guess here, as Svegliatevi nel cuore.
Almost Svegliatevi nel cuore.
Svegliatevi nel cuore. Nel cuore, beg your pardon. What is he singing about here?
He's talking about this awakening in his heart of the desire to the fury that's been awoken because of what's unfolded and what the path that lies before him.
Well, let's have a listen to that aria in a recording that features the aforementioned Nicholas McGeoghegan,
whom you will not hear at all because I'm conducting.
Yeah,
you can't hear me wave my arms around.
Yeah, well, you can wave them here. People can watch you on the live stream.
Yes, absolutely.
Svegliatevi Nel Core, the Act One aria of Sesto from Handel's Julius Caesar, as it will be sung by Sharon Carthy as part of the Blackwater Opera Festival. But I did mention before we went into that, Nicholas McGeegan, who will be conducting the performance in Lismore, that it was you conducting there as well. And you were telling us quite sadly that the person who was singing there died quite young.
Yes, her name was Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. That recording was made about 1990, and we made a lot of recordings together. And very sadly, in about 2006, she died of cancer in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Yeah, and subsequent family tragedies.
Her sister had died a couple of years before, and then her husband died a couple of years after.
Very, very sad indeed. But lovely that you have that recording. Singing music like that to express what are very contemporary emotions, which in some ways feels like ancient music, does it feel ancient to you at all, Sharon, when singing it?
No, not at all. I think that's one of the amazing things about this sort of art, whether it's like, you know, you mentioned Shakespeare before, or, you know, an opera with a libretto that was written 300 or 400 years ago, whatever it is, that there's these universal human themes that are, you know, we haven't changed that much in the last 250 years, that everyone can relate to that. I think that's the brilliant thing about opera as well, that like, it's not like going to the cinema to rewatch the same movie. So with Nick and Tom and the cast that we have in Blackwater, it's going to be a really unique kind of melting pot of our take on it.
Of course, you had the misfortune to mention your PE teaching days in an article.
Did I?
In the newspaper. How useful is your PE background when it comes to performing this very athletic music?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I approach singing as quite an athletic activity.
It is
I guess.
Very physical activity.
And I suppose being sporty and kind of having been a bit of a tomboy as a kid makes the physicality of, you know, playing teenage boys quite fun. So, yeah.
Well, listen, I'll give people the details of it afterwards, but I just want to listen to perhaps a quieter, more reflective section. I think this is a Cleopatra aria, Nicholas, from later on, the scene three aria, Piangero la sorte mia.
That's right. She's ended up in jail by her brother, who put her in jail. And she says, you know, I will always lament my fate, and you can tell probably that her life is not going to be very long in jail because...
Well, she's not happy singing this.
She's not happy.
If Sesto was angry, this is the... Piangere must be pains or...
I will weep. I shall weep for my dreadful...
situation.
Future.
Yeah.
Which is not long.
Not long. Let's have a listen to that. And thank you. I'll give people details on the event after we listen to a bit of it. Thanks so much for coming in. There she is singing of her a very short future ahead, the character of Cleopatra. And it'll actually be Anna Devon, I believe, who will be playing that character in the upcoming production, which we were speaking about there with Nicholas McGeegan, Tom Creed and Sharon Carty. Few tickets left, I believe, for Julius Caesar as part of the Blackwater Festival Opera, Sunday the 2nd of June. Full information on blackwatervalleyopera.ie. Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction celebrates its 30th anniversary this year. Yes, indeed, this cult classic continues to captivate audiences with its blend of razor-sharp dialogue, unforgettable characters and non-linear storytelling set in Los Angeles in the 1990s. Crime and pop culture collide in a film that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, but more importantly, forever changed the landscape of modern cinema. John McGuire is in studio with me this evening to look at the film's impact, its legacy and its enduring influence on pop culture. Yeah, yeah. 30 years.
30 years is a very long time. So.
Well, yeah, it dropped, that went fast, didn't it?
It did.
Essentially, just to remind us all, these are three pulp fiction stories.
That's right.
Stuck together.
Stuck together. That was Tarantino's approach. That's what he hit on. After the success of Reservoir Dogs in 1992, 1993, it had made a huge impression. I saw that on release in the cinema in 1992. I already knew who Tarantino was. We knew his story about him being the video clerk who'd started making movies. We knew his kind of what he was interested in was mashing together all these other world cinema styles and making it very Hollywood, making it very
postmodernism,
LA.
I guess we would refer to
postmodernism. Now, nobody talks much about postmodernism anymore, but in 1994, it was the buzzword to describe the culture: atomized, fragmented, broken up, mixed up, self-reflexive. And things were out of whack. The past had become the future. Retro styles and attitudes had taken on an ironic layer. We understood all the references. So we got Tarantino from Reservoir Dogs and his love of Asian cinema. And after that success, everybody was dying to see what was coming next. And what was coming next was massive.
Yeah, and of course, we were talking last night about Three Colors, Red, as it was.
Yeah.
Everybody thought in Cannes that year, it's the winner. And on the Saturday morning, along came Pulp.
He had spent three or four months in Amsterdam, in the coffee shops of Amsterdam, he's admitted himself, with no phone and no contact. It was the early 1990s. Mm. And he hit on this idea, like you say, of recycling three of the oldest stories in cinema. Yeah. There's the boxer who's supposed to throw a fight, the mob guy who falls in love with the boss's
Bruce
wife.
Willis is the boxer who the ex-boxer type
exactly
scenario.
The mob guy who falls in love with the boss's wife, who's played by John Travolta, which was a complete career reinvention, a resuscitation of Travolta's career. The boss's wife was played by Uma Thurman, who made her a star. The two hitmen, again, Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, made him a superstar. And they have to go over there and kill some guys and pick up something and get home. And these were the three stories. It was supposed to be a portmanteau of three chapters. He was going to direct one. His friend and co-writer, Roger Avery, was going to direct another. And then they were going to bring in another filmmaker to make the other. None of that happened. It didn't work out that way. Now, there was... Tarantino embellished all the dialogue. He wrote the story. He wanted this written and directed by credit on the film, as in all of his films. And he fitted Avery's story into his big idea and reportedly paid Avery $25,000 for it. But no matter how much he wrote about it and around it, and no matter how much he turned these three stories into one story, which is the real magic trick of Pulp Fiction, he would have to share the best screenplay Oscar with Avery in 1995.
And I presume a little bit of the profits.
And the money, of course. Well. Yeah, now there was, never mind that, because there was reports at the time of bad blood between them and there was a lawyer fight over the credit. But both men now, 30 years, Sean, is a long time, and both men now have said there's no bad blood and we're friends and everything is fine.
Who would we listen to first? Samuel?
Ezekiel 25:17, Sean, is burnt into your memory.
You read the Bible, Greg?
Yes!
Well, there's this passage I got memorized. It sort of fits this occasion. Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the inequities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
You can remember every word that's spoken.
Yeah. Nobody writes dialogue like Tarantino.
And I can still see, the word, he did find there was source material.
Everybody thought this, it's from the Bible, but it's not. It's from a opening crawl of a Sonny Chiba Hong Kong chop socky movie from the 1970s. Everybody was looking through their Bible saying, Ezekiel 25:17, there is doesn't exist, of course. And this is
certainly
the thing.
Not in that form.
It makes the film endlessly quotable and rewatchable, but so ingrained is Pulp Fiction in the popular consciousness that even as we're describing these characters and you played that clip, we can picture them in our heads. We can hear the individual lines of dialogue, the Royale with cheese, Zed's dead, baby Zed's dead. I mean, all of that stuff. instantly. It was instantaneous. This isn't a 30-year accretion of credibility. This film blew up overnight. It was quite extraordinary. I saw it on opening night in the Savoy One with my friends Aidan and Deborah on opening night on that Friday night. The worst seats in the house, we were one of the last people in. There was literally a queue around the corner. Front row center. They may as well have projected it on the ceiling. My head was tilted back so far.
And big screen.
It was electric. It was absolutely electric. Well, immediately.
If people were speaking along with Samuel L. Jackson in the previous clip, we know what they will be doing with their fingers on their eyes during this clip. So yeah, I was thinking of Uma Thurman and John Travolta dancing. They didn't dance to that.
No, no, they didn't. No, but Tarantino also had this hip and credibility, but he was also a geek and a nerd, and that no more than the collision between high culture and low culture, which is what Pulp Fiction is really all about. It is that collision between nerd culture and things that were actually genuinely cool. He was able to corral all of that together into this exciting and interesting story and then shatter it. That's what makes the film so interesting. He broke it completely and then put it back together. And it's so satisfying to watch this broken narrative fit together seamlessly by the end with the book ending with the honey bunny and the pumpkin.
They're the two who are robbing the
diner that we eventually start with and turn up at the end.
And I mean, the fact that we did see Uma Thurman and John Travolta dancing in this scene, his career was gone, but this really did resurrect it. And the fact that he was dancing there somehow added to that resurrection.
It's very self-reflexive. It was the times, this postmodern notion, and Pulp Fiction is the ultimate postmodern film. This notion that we know everything, we have a complete view, and you can put in any reference to anything and people will understand it and get it. And that's what he's so clever at.
And again, the casting of Bruce Willis in this in this role, this was a kind of change of direction for Bruce Willis as well, wasn't
Very
it?
Very much so. It gave him indie credibility. That's so what
just remind us of what his character was and where it fits into the story.
He plays a boxer who's asked by Marcellus Wallace, who played by Ving Rhames, who's the gangster at the centre of the story, to throw a fight for money. And he doesn't do it. Not only does he not throw the fight, but he actually kills the other boxer. So this puts him into a certain amount of hot water, and he has to get out of LA as quickly as possible. His girlfriend, Fabienne, who's played by the divine Maria de Medeiros, he has to go and get her and get out of LA, but she leaves the watch behind, and he has to go and get the watch. And we hear that there's a superb scene with Christopher Walken where he describes the history of this watch, and he has to go get back and get the watch, where he collides with John Travolta's character.
But there is a drive off on a chopper.
Don't give us the line too much away. Yeah, okay, I know. But it is 30 years old, Sean. That's the other thing. I mean, if you have to watch it, you would want to watch it.
Come on, honey.
Where did you get this motorcycle?
It's not a motorcycle, baby. It's a chopper. Come on, let's go.
What happened to my Honda?
I'm sorry, baby. I had to crash that Honda. Will you come on now, please? Come on, let's go. Let's go. Let's go.
You hurt?
No. I might have broken my nose. It's no biggie. Come on, hop on. Baby, please. Honey, we gotta hit the fucking road. Get on. I'm sorry. Come here. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
You were gone so long, I started to think dreadful thoughts.
Oh, I'm sorry, sweetie. I didn't mean to worry. Everything's fine. How was your breakfast?
It was good.
Did you get the pancakes? The blueberry pancakes?
I didn't have blueberry pancakes. I had to get buttermilk. Are you sure you're okay?
Honey, since I left you, this has been without a doubt the single weirdest fucking day of my life. Come on, hop on. I'll tell you all about it. Come on, get on. Gotta go. Come on.
Whose motorcycle is this?
It's a chopper, baby.
Whose chopper is this?
Zed's.
Who's Zed?
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
But every scene has just got this lift. Everything about it is just so elevated.
And we were saying even before the programme started, we were just checking through the clips and listening to that. Zed's dead, baby, Zed's dead. And then the sound of the thing.
It's so beautifully choreographed. Yeah, and Masterful, this is his second film. The guy was only in his early 30s.
What is the legacy? I mean, it's a phenomenal legacy, but what is the legacy of Pulp Fiction?
Well, we talked about Travolta, brought him back from the dead, made stars of Samuel L. Jackson and Uma Thurman. It also kind of weirdly and perversely created Harvey and Bob Weinstein. It created Miramax, and it created all of that Oscar campaigning that Miramax did. It made them into a really powerful entity in American cinema, but it had revolutionized American independent cinema as well. It was made for $8 million. It made more than $220 million around the world. Wow. Like you say, it won the Palme d'Or, won the Oscar. And it became the first American independent film to earn more than $100 million at the American box office, which was huge. And it cemented and created this independent auteur cinema as a commercial prospect in Hollywood.
Will you go and watch it somewhere on a big screen?
I'd love to see it on a big screen. I haven't seen... Now, every time I see it on the TV and you're flicking through the TV and it comes on, I will watch it. But I haven't seen it on the cinema, the big screen since I first saw it, but maybe at a better angle. Yeah, maybe
you
find
go a bit further back into the cinema
back
this
a little
time.
Bit, yeah.
John McGuire speaking to us about Pulp Fiction, which is 30 years old this year. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening here in Arena. Liam Murphy and Barbara Sanwo researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Pulp Fiction is available on Netflix. I am hearing just as we finish up. So if you want to watch it on whatever size screen you can manage at home, there's your chance. John Creedon will be with you after the news.